is 10 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland. Eric Cascadia and Locus Focus are off today. We'll hear a program from Radio EcoShock called GASP, Antarctica's Melting Unstoppable. At 11, Grace Eagle Reed hosts Disability Awareness, a monthly show about issues affecting people with disabilities and their communities. Her guest, Cheryl, talks about her personal experience with a treatment for MS. And at 11:30, the Radio Zine features an interview from Sea Change Radio with Jason Mark, editor of Earth Island Journal, on the Wilderness Act. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support during our recent membership drive. If you missed it, it's not too late to contribute. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to celebrate International Children's Day with Visegrad Group PDX on Sunday, June 1st from 1:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Brentwood Darlington Community Center, 7211 Southeast 62nd Avenue in Portland. We will celebrate children from around the world and honor the diverse cultures that exist and thrive in the Portland area. The International Children's Day festivities will offer a rich intercultural program that will include singing, acting, puppet shows, arts and crafts, and ethnic food. Again, that's International Children's Day with Visegrad Group PDX on Sunday, June 1st from 1:30 p.m. to 5 at the Brentwood Darlington Community Center, 7211 Southeast 62nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, I'm Shahid Hamid, and I want to invite you to a very special 8-hour Memorial Day Soul and Rhythm and Blues experience right here on KBOO 90.7 FM from 12 o'clock noon to 8 p.m. with JJ leading us off from 12 noon to 2 o'clock, followed by Sequoina Wright from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock p.m., followed by yours truly, Shahid, from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m., and Reggae Bob taking us home from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock p.m., from the old to the new, just for you, a very special Memorial Day Soul and Rhythm and Blues experience. Monday, May the 26th, 12 noon to 8 p.m., right here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, and online, www.kboo.fm radio.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
And now we'll go to Radio EcoShock. GASP, Antarctica Melting Unstoppable.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. But you won't hear much from me in this program. There is huge news from the Antarctic. Scientists fear that those glaciers will melt, lifting global sea levels above the streets of many world coastal cities, have been verified by two studies. Later in the program, you will hear an excellent interview of top climate scientist Kevin Trenberth, conducted by Peter Sinclair. But right now, we're going to bypass the mainstream media machine to hear from NASA scientists who say the melt of one Antarctic glacier set alone is unstoppable. We don't often get such certainty from science or large government agencies. This is a moment to gasp, like the record Arctic sea ice melt of 2007. The planet has undeniably and unmistakably been altered. It's a major tipping point crossed. Even without the Greenland ice melt, the Antarctic glaciers will reshape the geography of land for all conceivable generations to come. Think about that. Redraw the maps and realize humans will eventually withdraw from megacities ranging from New York to China. A retreat from the sea by millions of people, from trillions of dollars in assets. That's what this is all about. Here is an edited for radio replay of the NASA press conference held May 12th for the media. We begin with the voice of Thomas Wagner, NASA's program scientist for the cryosphere and director of the agency's polar studies. He is introducing the lead scientist for this Antarctic study, Eric Rigneault. Eric is professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. His last name is spelled R-I-G-N-O-T. You will hear his entire presentation for the NASA teleconference held May 12, 2014.
The results that you're going to hear about today are not based on computer simulations or numerical models. They are based on the interpretation of observations. And I think this is an important point because this sometimes can get lost on the general public when they're trying to understand climate change and the implications. And with that, I'll turn over right now to the study's lead author, Eric Rigneault.
Thank you, Tom. Welcome, everyone. My name is Eric Rigneault. Today, we present observational evidence that a large sector of the West Antarctic ice sheet has gone into a state of irreversible retreat. It has passed the point of no return. I'll guide you to inset number one, the map of Antarctica, showing the Amundsen Sea sector where it's located in the Antarctic. This retreat will have major consequences for sea level rise worldwide. It will raise sea level by 1.2 meters or 4 feet, but its retreat will also influence adjacent sectors of West Antarctic ice sheet, which could triple this contribution to sea level. We and many other colleagues have looked extensively at this part of the world over the last two decades, as Tom mentioned, with satellites, airplanes, ships, and ground survey. We have examined enough direct and independent observations of this area to conclude that the retreat of ice in that sector is unstoppable. A little bit of background. Back in the 70s, the great scientific minds of Terry Hughes and Bob Thomas and others recognized that this sector was a weak spot of Antarctica, which could respond rapidly to climate change. But we had to wait until the 1990s to study it because it's so remote. Then it was found that this area was undergoing changes. Warm water was present everywhere below the surface and eroding the glaciers faster than anywhere else in the Antarctic. Since then, we have paid a lot of attention to this sector, and we've also examined historical data. In a recent study published also in Geophysical Research Letters by Mugino et al., we reconstructed 40 years of evolution in this sector to show that ice discharge into the ocean has been continuously increasing for the past four decades, and especially so in the last 10, 15 years. We also found that these changes propagate rapidly over large distances, hundreds of kilometers inland over the whole glacier system. In our new published study of May 12 in Geophysical Research Letters, we present additional data that the junction of the glaciers with the ocean, the grounding line, I will explain that in a second, has been retreating at record speeds, unmatched anywhere in the Antarctic. We also present new evidence that there's no large hill in the back of these glaciers that could create a barrier and hold the retreat back. This is why we conclude that the disappearance of ice in that sector is unstoppable. Now, if you move to the first graphic, which is animation of grounding line, you'll see a vertical section of a glacier flowing into the ocean and developing into a floating extension. The grounding line is the imaginary line below the surface, where the glacier detaches from the bed and becomes afloat. Water temperature in this graphic is colored red, where it's warm at intermediate depth, about 400 meters below the surface. This water comes into contact with the glacier, melts it. The meltwater raises through the water column and entrains more ocean heat. And this circulation of ocean waters beneath the ice continuously removes ice at depth and takes it to the surface as meltwater. Now, if the amount of ocean heat that reaches the glacier increases with time, it melts the glacier faster, the grounding line retreats, the glacier feels less resistance to flow along its bed, it speeds up, it stretches and thins, and this is conducive to more retreat. Each process feeds into the next one. Now, I would like to ask you to move to the second animation called Animation of West Antarctic Ice Sheet Processes and click on it. It's about 2 minutes long. We are taking you to that part of Antarctica to show you actual observations. This sector is drained by six glaciers, the largest one, the giant Pine Island Glacier and Thwaites Glacier, 30 kilometers wide and 100 kilometers wide, respectively. They flow about 4 kilometers per year. The speed of these glaciers is color-coded. Red is fast, blue is slower, and green is the slowest. The glaciers flow into the sea and form floating extensions that we call ice shelves. Now in red, you're going to see areas where the flow speed has been increasing almost every year. The darker the red, the more the glaciers have been speeding up. You see that all the glaciers are speeding up, and the speed up is felt far inland. Now we focus our attention on the Smith Glacier, which is a smaller glacier that has experienced some of the most dramatic changes in recent decades. The grounding line of Smith Glacier in 1996 is at the transition boundary between the blue color, the ice shelf, and the white color, which is ice resting on the continent. Now the animation takes you to 2011. The grounding line is 35 kilometers farther back, a retreat of nearly 2 kilometers per year, and the glacier bed is now 800 meters deeper. If we could peel off ice from the continent and see the bed, this is what it would look like. The arrows you're going to see indicate the flow direction of ice. The color indicates the speed. Blue is slow, red is fast. We see that all these glaciers flow atop major deep subglacial valleys colored in brown. And the darker the brown color, the deeper the valleys. The farther inland you go, the deeper the valley. As the glacier retreat, they follow these deep valleys. In our new reconstruction of the glacier bed using advanced techniques, we see more details than ever before, but we find no mountains or large hills along the way that could act as a barrier to hold these glaciers back. They will keep sliding back until the ice is gone. So the glaciers speed up, the grounding line retreat, the deep valleys sloping inland all reinforce each other to make the retreat unstoppable. Now back from the video, one of the most striking feature of these glaciers is that they have been reacting almost simultaneously, and this suggests a common forcing that can only be the ocean. We suspect that the advection of ocean heat onto these glaciers has increased in the recent past and has precipitated these glaciers into a state of rapid retreat that now appears to be unstoppable. You may ask, how does this relate to climate warming? It does, even though the situation is more complex than it would be in Greenland. The advection of ocean heat towards Antarctica is controlled by its wind regime, and we believe that the wind regime around Antarctica has been changing. The winds have increased in intensity and shifted poleward, which results in more warm water advected towards the glaciers. In summary, we have gathered enough evidence over the past two decades and even going back to historical data to reach our conclusion. And now I'll pass it on to Sridhar. We can put these results into a larger context.
This is Radio EcoShock passing on new science about the unstoppable melting of Antarctic glaciers. Our next speaker at the NASA teleconference is Sridhar Anandakrishnan, professor of geosciences at Pennsylvania State University.
Thank you, Eric. This is Sridhar Anandakrishnan. I'm at Penn State University, and I'm not directly associated with this study, though I have worked in Antarctic and Greenland for nearly three decades, and in particular on Thwaites Glacier. I've done groundwork there that I'll talk about in a little bit. In this study, the authors have shown that a part of Antarctica, known as the Amundsen Sea Embayment, is undergoing enormous change. I wanted to put that in some historical and perhaps even global context. As many of you know, one of the impacts of ongoing human-caused climate change is a rise in sea level. For the past few decades, that rise has been driven in large measure by factors other than the loss of ice from Antarctica and Greenland. Certainly that those have been a factor, but the larger factor has been things like warming of the oceans that causes the water to expand and other factors. However, from this and other studies in the recent past, it's becoming pretty clear that the major ice sheets of this planet will have a larger and larger role in sea level rise in the decades ahead. As glaciers and ice sheets flow faster, that ice has nowhere to go but into the ocean. And once in the ocean, this results in a rise in sea level around the globe. You've added water to a finite space, and the water's going to go up. To put this in a global context, on the website, there's a map of the globe. Image number 4, Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets, showing Greenland to the north and Antarctica, West and East Antarctica, as they're known, at the South Pole. The measured loss of ice has been greatest from Greenland, where the warming of the air and the oceans is amplified and intensified. Thus far, the loss of ice from Antarctica has not been of the same scale. This appears to be changing from the measurements that Dr. Mugino, Reno, and others have done. Antarctica is traditionally divided into two parts, West Antarctica, where much of the bottom of the ice is below sea level, and East Antarctica, where much of it is above sea level. And from a glaciological and a climatological perspective, that's the critical distinction between these two. In this study, the authors show that West Antarctica, including the large glaciers of Thwaites and Pine Island, but really the entire coastline, is changing. The ice is flowing faster, which puts more water into the ocean, and the boundary between ocean and ice, the grounding line that Eric alluded to, is retreating inland. In West Antarctica, the situation is particularly bad because, as I said, the ground is below sea level because the ice flow is related to how thick the ice is at the grounding line. And as the grounding line retreats inland, the ice at that grounding line gets thicker and thicker. And you can see that in that animation number 2, which shows it very clearly. So it's a positive feedback. The ice flows faster, the grounding line retreats, the ice at the grounding line gets thicker, so the ice flows faster, and away it goes. These results show that projections of sea level will likely have to change and be changed upwards as the Amundsen Sea embayment is better understood. Now, as Eric said, people have been talking about this since the 70s. Some very famous glaciologists have referred to this as the, quote, weak underbelly of West Antarctica. But because of its remoteness, it's been very, very tough to get to this area. That's where NASA's ability to look at the continent from space and planes comes in, and NSF, National Science Foundation's ability to put us on the ground, as they did for me and my students and colleagues a number of times, to look at Thwaites Glacier is really, really important. Work is ongoing. We need to apply all the tools to hand to better quantify and project how the warming oceans around Western Antarctica will affect sea level that then turns around and affects us all. So with that, I'm going to turn it over back to Steve, and I think he will ask for questions.
I'm going to play you selections from the question and answer period for the press at the NASA teleconference May 12th. For once, the brightest reporters asked intelligent questions with answers that reveal more about this historic discovery by NASA.
We have a couple of questions already in from social media. The first one is directed to Eric. How quickly will all the ice in this basin flow into the sea?
University of California scientist and lead author Eric Rignot answers.
We do not present projection of the evolution of ice in that sector. If it continues to retreat at the current rate, we're looking at the retreat of ice with this basin within the next two centuries. It could proceed faster or slower. This is something that's be addressed by more advanced numerical models.
Okay, thank you, Eric. And now we do have a call from the phone lines. Seth Bornstein for the Associated Press.
Yes, thank you for doing this. And this is also for Eric, continuing along that line. The Ian Joffin paper, which has just been released to coincide with yours, is more computer modeling, and yours is observational. It's talking as much as 3 to 4 meters within several hundred years. You're talking 1.2 meters or so. Obviously, I was going to ask you the difference, and I don't want you to say 2.5 meters. Why are their projections, which are more models, bigger than yours? And are you more confident, or is there a timeline difference? And what's the outer edge of your, essentially your sea level rise?
Eric Rignot replies.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. It will help clarify the situation a little bit. When we quote 1.2 meter or 4 feet, It relates only to the drainage basin of Pine Island and Twiss Glacier and the neighboring glaciers. But we know from the configuration of West Antarctica that as ice will keep retreating farther inland into that basin, it will affect other basins in the West Antarctic ice sheet. There are two other major basins in the West Antarctic ice sheet that are currently buttressed, held back by very large ice shelves, which are somehow more protected from climate change. But as the retreat of these glaciers will reach farther inland, it will affect these glaciers as well. And if you include all of them into the projection, then you'll get to another 10, 15 feet of sea level changes. What we're presenting today is mostly observational evidence of changes ongoing in the Pine Island Thwaites sector. In the other sectors draining the Antarctic ice sheet, one of them does not change very much right now. And in the other one, there's some places thinning and thickening, but there's a consensus that all these changes are acclimatic. They're not responding to climate change as of now.
John Amos, your line is now open.
Thanks very much, Steve. Yes, Jonathan Amos from the BBC in London here. There was some talk over the past few months of the pig having slowed. I don't know if that was confirmed with the ice bridge flights or with some of the satellite data that you've seen, but I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good point. The Pine Island Glacier has reduced its acceleration in recent years. We see that fairly clearly when we examine the 40-year record of speed on Pine Island. This is a result of a very rapid period of retreat starting around 2002, where the glaciers retreated about 30 kilometers in just a few years. This was an area where the glacier was barely above hydrostatic equilibrium, so it was able to retreat through that area very quickly. I think you could see the recent lack of speed up of Pine Island as I would say the glacier is kind of breathing through that episode of very rapid retreat it went through. If you put that in the context of the long-term evolution of the glacier, it's just a little bump in the signal. When we look at the collective ice discharge from all the glaciers in the Amazon Sea, which includes Thwaites, we find that ice discharge in that sector is still on the increase. Because while Pine Island has not been speeding up in the last couple of years, Thwaites Glacier has been speeding up since 2006, which was a big surprise for us, and is kind of picking up on where Pine Island left it. We do expect to see things like that happen regularly through time. From year to year, things can change a little bit. So it's really important when looking at this observational evidence to look at the long-term trend of these glaciers.
The next question is coming from Tracy Watson. Your line is now open.
Thanks. I just wanted to find out, do you expect any significant addition to sea level rise from this phenomenon before 2010, because the IPCC said they really didn't expect much in that way? Thank you.
This is Sridhar. I can talk about that a little bit. So the question, I think, was whether by 2100 there will be a change in the IPCC, whether the IPCC projection for 2100 will be different on the basis of these results. And I think that certainly is true. The IPCC projections don't really include Antarctic contributions to any great measure, just in large part because the results are only now starting to come together, showing the importance of particularly of West Antarctica and of this segment of West Antarctica. And the IPCC being a very works very much on the published record. So as this paper and other papers like this keep coming out, the IPCC numbers for 2100 will almost certainly be revised and revised upwards. And my guess is towards what is now their upper limit of something like 90 centimeters, about close to 3 feet. I think it's going to move up in that direction, but how much is still not clear.
Alan Boyle with NBC News. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I wanted to ask about the inevitability of the process. Why would you say that it's unstoppable? I suppose some folks might say that perhaps this is a cyclic thing and the cycle could be reversed. Maybe there will be a change in currents that could lead to a stop of the trend. Maybe you could provide a little more information on that point.
Eric Rigneau replies.
Yeah, I can speak to that. The reason why it's unstoppable is that we have a number of physical processes interplayed, playing with each other and providing what we call a positive feedback. That's what we call it in science. Of course, to the general public, a positive feedback might sound like a good thing, but for these glaciers, that's not a good thing. As they retreat farther inland, as Sridhar mentioned, the velocity at the grounding line, where it's getting thicker, is increasing. The glaciers are thinning faster. The grounding line is thinning, is retreating. And the ocean waters that carry ocean heat towards the glaciers keep following these glaciers. And the glaciers, as they get deeper, they can also melt faster in contact with the ocean. We feel that this is at the point where even if the ocean is not warming up, is not providing additional ocean heat, the system is in sort of a chain reaction that is unstoppable. Every process is of retreat feeding the next one. The only process that could slow down this retreat is if we could find some large hill or mountains in the back of these glaciers at some place where the glaciers would have to climb uphill and maybe escape from the ocean waters or slow down the retreat. But we've looked at that with a lot of details, and thanks to a lot of data acquired by NASA during Operation IceBridge, combined with some other data, we are fairly confident that there was no such hill or big mountains in the back that could slow down this retreat. So we think that it's not going to be stoppable.
Daryl Fears with The Washington Post. Your line is now open.
Hi, thanks. For some time now, a number of scientists have said that the IPCC's projections for sea level rise have been much too conservative, and you've been watching this phenomenon for some time, and I'm wondering if this has been anticipated, if this event is one of the reasons why scientists have been saying that those numbers for sea level rise are much too low. Is this something that the science community has seen coming for some time, and now you're saying it's upon us, it's happening?
This is Sridhar. That's a really good question, and it certainly has been a topic of conversation that the IPCC numbers are, by the very nature of the process, on the conservative side. They have to be. They're a consensus. And so they work off of the published literature. They say, what papers are out there? What are the numbers that they give us? What is our confidence in those numbers? And a lot of this work is just coming out now. And if this work were not coming out, then we wouldn't be talking about revising the numbers. And the way we do our work is that this is one of the papers that is coming out now. But certainly the work that goes into it has been going on for a number of years, and there have been other work showing indications of this. This is the first really strong, measured result, something that says we've been watching this area for 40 years with a variety of tools, and now we're starting to see the retreat. And as this paper becomes part of the published literature, it will then be cited in the next report. And that's the way that IPCC process works.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are listening to a groundbreaking NASA teleconference for journalists about the unstoppable melting of glaciers in Antarctica and what that means for world sea level rise.
Kenneth Chang, The New York Times. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you. I just want to clarify, Dr. Rigneau said 200 years. That's just for this basin. I guess, does he see the entire ice sheet going away? And if so, how long would that take? And I guess my other question is, if it's inevitable, what influence does future carbon emissions have on this?
Lead scientist Eric Rigneau answers.
We do think that this is related to climate warming. It has climate warming combined with changes in stratospheric circulation in the Antarctic due to the depletion of the ozone, has increased the intensity of the westerlies and it has shifted poleward. This has contributed to the advection of ocean heat around some critical sectors of Antarctica. So you could sort of think that if this situation is exacerbated, the advection of ocean heat towards the Antarctic continent will only increase, and it will precipitate, it will enhance the retreat of these glaciers, it will make the retreat of these glaciers faster.
Pat Brennan, Orange County Register, next.
Hello, is it correct to say that those glaciers are in a state of irreversible collapse?
Well, we haven't used the word collapse. Collapse, I think, in the imagination of most people, sounds like a catastrophic event that's going to happen in the next few years. We're talking about a retreat that is unstoppable because we think we have enough evidence to say that these glaciers will keep retreating for decades and even centuries to come, and will keep contributing to sea level rise. But we're not talking about a collapse such as the collapse of the Larsen B ice shelf, which disappeared in 3 weeks in 2002. We're talking about a slow degradation of ice in this part of Antarctica. But maybe this is the way most ice sheet collapse in the real world. We have never seen one before.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're covering a NASA teleconference for the press about the melting of Antarctic glaciers.
Question. Is there anything that can be done to reverse this trend, or there's nothing that could happen that would keep these glaciers from melting?
Okay, I'll just say something brief on it because I don't want to speculate on some of that. But I think what we're showing today is observational evidence that guides us to say that this sector of West Antarctica is changing. Ice is going to retreat from this sector for decades and centuries to come, and we can't stop it. Now, the speed at which these glaciers will retreat will certainly be affected by climate forcing. As I mentioned before, if climate warming continues and the westerlies increase in intensity and the ice sheet starts to melt at the surface, which it doesn't now, it's quite likely that the retreat of these glaciers will actually accelerate in the future rather than slow down. So it will somehow affect on how fast ice will retreat from this part of Antarctica. It may not decide on whether it's going to stop it or not, but it will have an effect definitely on how fast ice will move out of this sector.
Again, lead scientist Eric Rigneau is asked for his reaction to these findings that Antarctica is committed to melting.
Yes, I think I was surprised. You know, I've been looking at these glaciers myself for about 20 years, and you would expect that by now any new data that falls onto my table is like, ah, I knew that. It's not the case. When we imaged the grounding line of Smith Glacier using the ERS data from 2011, I expected the grounding line to have retreated quite a bit since we had the last chance to look at it. But I honestly didn't expect it to be that far back. 35 kilometers is probably some of the extreme numbers I was picturing in my mind. So these glaciers are retreating fast. I think it's a general picture that we have looking at these satellite airborne data and in-situ data is that these systems, whether it's Greenland or Antarctic, are changing on faster timescales than we anticipated. And we are kind of rediscovering that every day.
Daryl Fears, The Washington Post, your line is open.
Thank you. I hate to keep taking you back to this, but I just want to be absolutely sure. Do you believe that carbon emissions have had an effect on this acceleration at all? Or are we looking at something that may be natural? And I'm asking this question because of something Eric said earlier, that this may be something that happens all the time. We're just seeing it for the first time. Do you believe carbon emissions have had an effect on the retreat of this ice? And or is this something that could be part of a natural process?
Eric Rigneault fields this question.
This is a good question. I'll first say that as a remote sensing scientist, I do not believe in these things. I look at actual data. I mentioned that these changes are related to climate warming because the advection of ocean heat towards the continent is controlled by the wind regime around Antarctica, what we call the southern hemisphere annular mode. And there's been a strengthening of these winds since probably the 1980s, which is related in part to climate warming because Antarctica is not warming as fast as the rest of the world. It increases the pressure differential between Antarctica and the rest of the world, and that increases the intensity of these winds. There's also some changes caused by the depletion of the ozone that affected the stratospheric circulation that also contribute to a strengthening of the westerlies. The jury is still out as to which part of the which physical process dominates in that, but they work in concert to increase the circulation of winds of Antarctica, which will contribute to advecting more heat from the subsurface ocean towards the Antarctic coastline. And model projections are that with a continuous increase in greenhouse warming, the strength of these winds will keep increasing. But this is going a little bit beyond the topic of discussion of today.
And our last question is from Seth Borenstein, the Associated Press.
Yes, Eric, I just want to make sure I'm right. Is it fair, or if this is not a good analogy, can you try to give me a better analogy on the grounding line issue here, the retreat? Is it almost like a breach of a dam where there's just everything had been held back and now you don't have those mountains or low-lying hills and now you just have that steady march? Or is there a better analogy than that?
Eric Rigneault replies.
The breaching of a dam is a good one. I like to refer to the one that Bob Thomas used in the early days when he was talking about instability of Western Antarctic ice sheet. He compared it to a bottle, let's say a wine bottle, that has a cork at the front, and the cork represents the ice shelf. And he argued that if the ice shelf was weakening and contributing to grounding line retreat, it would be equivalent to uncorking the bottle, and the wine would run out. So I think we are sort of at the point where we can say that the bottle has been uncorked. We can't tell exactly when this happened and who did it, but this is a good analogy as well.
That concludes the Radio EcoShock replay of a NASA press teleconference, May 12, 2014. It announced a new study showing the melting of certain Antarctic glaciers was now unstoppable. And that's due to climate change induced by human beings. You can find a link to the full 1 hour, 8 minute teleconference on Ustream with some charts in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info, published every Wednesday. That's ecoshock.info. In the blog, I also add more of my own observations about this study and a second study with similar findings, but that one was based on sophisticated computer models. The NASA project depended on satellite observations, airplane flyovers, and some ground measurements. I'm Alex Smith. My thanks to NASA and the study authors for making this information public.
What we're seeing is a situation where the metabolism of our 20th century economy is on an absolute collision course with the metabolism of planet Earth.
Forest fires will increase with global warming. And if you look in regions like Canada, Siberia, where there isn't a smoky bear putting out these things, we see big increases in forest fires as global warming is occurring.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock as we relay breaking news, historic news. Last week, I interviewed scientists about El Niño, the weather-making system that will rock our world starting in late 2014. How serious is it? Let's listen in to a video interview done by Peter Sinclair, who runs the Climate Denial Croc of the Week website. That's a hot spot to visit often at climatecrocs.com. The guest is the eminent climate scientist Kevin Trenberth. He's an expert's expert, listed as a distinguished senior scientist in the climate analysis section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research.
We've been hearing rumblings over the last several months about a possible El Nino event. Can you tell us what is it that scientists are seeing that is some kind of a clue on this, and what does that mean? What does that tell us?
Well, I think the announcements that have come out, the official announcements from the Weather Service, the Climate Prediction Center, have been very conservative on this front. There are some things going on in the tropical Pacific Ocean right now that we haven't seen since the 1997-98 El Nino event. And so I don't think the question is whether it's going to be an El Nino. I think we're going to have an El Nino. The question is how large it is going to be and whether we will see something as big and therefore as disruptive as the 1997-98 event. That's the really big question that's out there. So there are changes already underway after most of this century being dominated by relatively cool conditions over a lot of the tropical Pacific Ocean. La Nina conditions, as we refer to them, with some small, weak to moderate El Nino events that have occurred. In association with an El Nino event, there is some disruption of the winds in the tropical Western Pacific. We've seen three really strong such disruptions occur this year. These are often referred to as westerly wind bursts, something like that. And so normally in the tropics, we have trade winds. So there's the northeasterly trade winds, southeasterly trade winds. If we get a westerly wind burst, in other words, the winds turn around and come from the other direction in association with some weather disturbances in the atmosphere, then that begins to drive the currents in the ocean in another direction. And it sets off some events within the ocean that push down the cold water. And that effect tends to propagate across the Pacific. And we're seeing that so that at 150 meters depth, there are now ocean temperatures that are 6 degrees Celsius, 10 or 11 degrees Fahrenheit, above normal. We haven't seen that, those kind of temperatures, since the 1997-98 event. In fact, that's the only time we've seen them, because we really haven't had sufficient observations before about 1992 to see them earlier than that.
Okay, does that, given the lack of records on that, do we think that that's unusually warm for an El Nino?
We think so. So we've seen, you know, smaller El Nino events. And under those smaller El Nino events, we get anomalies of 2 to 3 degrees Celsius in the what is called the thermocline, the divide between the warm mixed upper ocean and the deeper, much cooler ocean well below the surface.
Okay, so we're looking at potentially as large an event or approaching the 1998 event, which I understand was the largest ever recorded. Is that correct?
Certainly in some respects, that's true. The 1997 event had the biggest changes in the sea temperature that we've ever recorded. It's a slightly different perspective from the standpoint of the atmosphere. The 1982-83 event had slightly larger perturbations in what is called the Southern Oscillation Index, which is sort of a measure of some of the changes that are going on in the atmosphere in association with this. So, but those are the two big ones. Those are the only two big ones, and we can trace that record back to about 1870 fairly reliably. So, you know, in the last 140 years or something, there are two super El Ninos, and those are the ones.
So what does that mean in terms of global weather and climate?
In the first place, 1997 was the most active hurricane year on record. Now, all of that activity was in the tropical Pacific. And so it's likely that the tropical Pacific will warm up in the next month or so, even more than it has now. And so this could well be in time for the hurricane season this year. And what this means is you have a much warmer central and eastern, especially eastern, tropical Pacific Ocean. There's a very active hurricane season in the region west of Mexico, and elsewhere in the Pacific, there's a greater threat of hurricanes going into Hawaii and in the Southern Hemisphere, into Tahiti at some points. On the other hand, a very weak hurricane season in the Atlantic. So these are the first immediate things that begin to have important effects throughout the tropics. And a key question will be whether the El Nino kicks in soon enough to really adversely affect the monsoons in Southeast Asia. It may be that they will get going sufficiently that it won't be a major factor, but certainly there's a potential also for rather weak monsoons in Asia, and there are some effects in Africa and South America as well. So the weather patterns in the tropics already get disrupted. But the time when these El Nino events tend to peak is around December in terms of the sea temperatures. And in terms of their influence on the atmosphere, it's more like December, January, February, maybe around February they tend to peak next year. And this has a profound effect throughout the American Rim countries, but across the United States in particular. The El Nino itself is not fully cranked up, and one of the things we're waiting for is to see how well this connectivity between what's going on in the ocean that we can already monitor and see, and the effects of that on the sea temperatures, and then the changes in the winds and the real wind patterns across the Pacific. And so that connection hasn't been fully established yet, and we're waiting for that. And on a time scale of about a month, one more month, we will have a much better feel, I think, for whether this thing is really going to crank up or not. But yeah, this could have influences on the deep summer around the world, okay. Northern Hemisphere summer.
We know that the ocean has been gaining heat year by year, so the total available ocean heat is going to be greater now than it was back in 1997, which you said was a big hurricane year. So what should we derive from that?
Well, a lot of the heat is not necessarily in the Pacific. The Pacific has got some very characteristic patterns associated with it. There's a phenomenon that we refer to as the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And so in general, in the Western Pacific, it has warmed quite a lot. Sea level has gone up quite substantially. Sea level up till the end of, say, 2013, thereabouts, had gone up since we've made measurements, which began from altimetry in satellites in 1992. Sea level had gone up there about 20 centimeters, about 8 inches. On a global basis, sea level has gone up about 2.9 inches. So that's the global average. But in the eastern Pacific, in some places, it has actually fallen over that period of time. And so there's an increased gradient across the Pacific. The water, in other words, is piling up in the western part of the Pacific. This is one of the things that helps to lead to the El Nino event itself. And we can already see this underway. Already in the last 4 months, the sea level has gone up by about 10 centimeters in the central and eastern Pacific. And so some things are already underway in that regard. So there is a redistribution of the heat, but it has to overcome the fact that conditions have been actually below normal or even quite cold, and they're still cold in the southern hemisphere, especially south of the equator.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to Peter Sinclair of ClimateCrocs.com interviewing one of the world's top climate scientists, Kevin Trenberth. The topic is the coming El Nino.
Okay, so you mentioned the PDO, and some people have told me that we have switched the phases of the PDO right around the time of that 98 El Nino.
We were in a positive phase from 1976 up until 1998.
Right. We're in a negative phase.
And then we went into this negative phase up until about now. And that's the symptom of it, is it tends to favor these things called La Niñas over El Niños. And we certainly think that it's quite plausible that that 1997-98 event is what kicked us into that negative phase. There was a tremendous amount of heat that came out of the ocean in association with that event. That's one of the things which puts more moisture into the atmosphere. It's one of the things that led to that very active hurricane season in 1997. There's a lot of extra fuel for weather systems in general around the world with all of this extra moisture that goes into the atmosphere in association with this. So the ocean tends to lose heat. That leads to a mini global warming in the atmosphere. And so this does tend to lead then to a year or two of higher temperatures where the global mean temperature goes up. And so that's one of the other prospects that we can look forward to. But at the same time, you know, the ocean has lost some of that heat that it's been storing up.
Okay, so we've been in a period for the last decade that has favored La Nina events, where the ocean tends to suck that heat in and kind of dampen global temperatures.
That's right. And some of that heat's gone quite deep as well.
And so what this has been part of the dialogue between scientists and those that say that global warming has stopped or slowed down. Can you speak to that a little bit?
This is right. We think that since 1998, in this negative phase of the specific decadal oscillation, that there has been some changes in the atmospheric winds at the surface. In turn, these have changed the ocean currents. They have changed the overturning currents within the ocean. And more heat has been pulled down in the subtropics, in both the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, away from the surface. So more heat has been buried in some deeper parts of the ocean. But there's also been effects in other parts of the ocean, even into the North Atlantic and over the southern oceans. And there, some of the heat has been buried even deeper. And that stuff is not coming back in any short-term fashion. That's sort of a part of the overall global warming, if you like to think of it that way, that, you know, since the planet is heating up, the oceans have to heat up, and that's a part of the process which is going on as well. So in the Pacific has some uniqueness in that regard, in that it can take up heat, store it for a while, and then give it back. But some of the heat has simply warmed up the ocean and is probably not coming back.
So we know we are able to measure the heat that is going into the deep ocean. Is that correct?
Well, we have estimates. I wish they were better than they are. We only really have a good ocean observing system since about 2006 on. This is the Argo system of floats that are deployed around 1,000 meters below the surface, and then they go down and to 2,000 meters, and they pop up to the surface and make measurements of temperature and salinity along the way, and then they telemeter that back to through satellites to ground stations, and we can track what's going on in the ocean now in ways that we never could before. And there are about, you know, there are over 3,000 of these so-called Argo floats around the world that are measuring the ocean in ways we never saw before. 1992 was a key time, or the end of 1992. That was when altimeters went up, so we can measure global sea level more accurately. And that gives us an overall feel for what's going on in the ocean, where the warm water is and where it isn't, and whether or not the ocean is expanding. And so there's an overall increase in heat in the ocean, but it doesn't give us the detailed information about what's going on below the surface. But before 1992, the information on the ocean is more fragmentary. We do have things called expendable bathythermographs. So there's some measurements that go back to about the 1970s. Before the 1970s, not so much.
Okay. When we look at the temperature record globally over the last 20-some years or so, there does seem to be the spikes of global temperature do seem to follow more or less the El Niño cycle.
That's correct.
And so
the El Nino years, in fact, yes.
Right. So
1998 was the warmest year last century as all of this heat came out of the ocean in association with the 1997-98 El Nino event.
Right. And then 2005, 2007, 2010, those were all sort of minor El Nino kind of years. Right. Okay, so what does that lead us to believe if we are indeed going into a large El Nino event?
Well, we can certainly say with great confidence that this year is going to be very different than quite a number of the years we've seen so far this century. And, you know, the prospects are that it'll be quite different. Across North America in the wintertime, this tends to favor a much more active jet stream and storm track across the southern parts of the United States. And so storms barreling into Southern California, and sea level is also higher off the coast of Southern California. This increases greatly the risk of erosion. And last time in 1997-98, there were pictures of houses toppling into the ocean because of that tremendous erosion that occurred. So the good thing is that it tends to break the drought in the southern parts of California, and the wet weather actually continues all the way across the south, across through Texas and even into Florida, cutting down on the risk of wildfires and all throughout that region. At the same time, it tends to be a bit warmer and drier in the northern tier states in the United States. And so it does tend to be warmer as a whole, but the southern tier states actually are a bit wetter.
Okay. Is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you think is particularly important for people to know?
Well, one of the key questions is whether some of these events are sufficient to change this thing called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. Will it change it back into a positive phase again? You know, the biggest pileup of water in the Pacific or anywhere in the world over this recent period was in the vicinity of the Philippines. That's one of the things which led to this super typhoon, Haiyan, that went through the Philippines late last year. And the sea level was, as I say, about 8 inches higher than it had been in the 1990s or earlier. And because the water was so warm in that region, there was plenty of fuel for the storm to feed upon. As that big storm came in and churns up the water, instead of feeling colder water below the surface, there was still more warm water down below the surface. So that storm was firstly fueled by that, and then it's riding on higher sea level. The storm surge was so much worse as a consequence of that. Well, you know, are we going to change that? Already, the sea level has dropped quite a bit in the area of the Philippines. And, you know, that's far enough off the equator that there's some indications that it's more than El Nino going on, I think, at the moment. And so one of the real prospects to look out for is whether we go back into a different phase of this Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And one of the potential prospects we can watch out for is whether the next whole decade will be distinctly warmer. And so, you know, in terms of the global mean temperature, instead of having a gradual trend going up, maybe the way to think of it is that we have a series of steps, like a staircase, and it's possible that we're approaching one of those steps, and we will go up, you know, 2 or 3 tenths of a degree Celsius to a next level, and maybe we won't come down again. I think that's one of the things we could possibly look out for.
Wow. That's sobering. So I think that's all I can process for right now. That's a tremendous amount.
That was Kevin Trenberth from NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Notice that Trenberth also wonders whether this coming El Nino could trip us into a warmer world, a hotter time from which we never cool down. I've suggested that several times. This interview is courtesy of Peter Sinclair. His blog, Climate Denial Croc of the Week, is simply excellent. It's hot. Don't miss it at climatecrocs.com. Find links for this show in my blog at ecoshock.info. Find all our past programs at the website ecoshock.org, or listen to what's new at the Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page. Next week, I've got more news from a warming world and some controversial guests. Thanks for listening. And join me again on Radio EcoShock. And I want to go out, though, with a special piece of climate music written by Dana Pearson in California. He's known as Vast Mandana on SoundClick.com. He's thinking of calling himself Climate Man. Whatever he calls himself, this is a great piece. And it's about the very topic we've been covering, which is the flooding. And this time, it's the flooding in Florida, which just happened and will happen again and again as we listen to the news.
was raining by the afternoon. Everything was underwater. By the very next morning, it was still raining, and all the cars we had were floating away.
And you are tuned to KBOO in Portland. Coming up next, Grace Eagle Reed hosts Disability Awareness, and she's in the studio now with two, three other folks. And I have one's name is Cheryl, and she'll introduce you to them when the time comes. So stay tuned for that, and then stay tuned at 11:30. The Radio Zine features an interview with Sea Change Radio with Jason Mark, editor of Earth Island Journal, on the Wilderness Act. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support during our recent membership drive. If you missed it, it's not too late to contribute. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
The Union of Time Thieves is a monthly exploration of urban life. In this installment, we'll be exploring the concept of psychogeography, taking a look at its development, and then collaboratively constructing a new map in a practical application of the theory. Join us for an hour of the visual made verbal on The Union of Time Thieves on May 26th from 10 to 11 p.m. only on KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 14th Annual Village Building Convergence from Friday, May 23rd to Sunday, June 1st. The Village Building Convergence is a 10-day placemaking and urban